lovely you're all here, and it's lovely to be invited here, so thanks very much for that call. And I feel that that introduction was pertinent to an earlier version of Grace Wells, and unfortunately she's not here this evening, and you've got this one instead, because for the last 4 years I've been working on a novel that's set in 19th century Ireland. And that's really what's influencing me at the moment. When I say that I'm ecologically driven, that means that I drive around the countryside on a little soapbox in my head, groaning and moaning about the state of the natural world and what we're doing to it. So I'm going to try to stay off my soapbox as much as possible this evening. May not work. It was lovely to be introduced together with Lani, because one thing that that sheet of paper didn't say is that Lani and I have become really great friends in the last number of years. And I'm very aware that there's a lot of young writers in this room, and I would love to offer you some kind of sound advice about being a writer. But probably the most nourishing thing that you can have is a writing friend. And if you ever get as good as Lani has been to me in the last number of years, you're going to be, it's going to be one of those star destiny kind of friendships that really supports and nourishes your work. And I'm just delighted to be with him down in Cork tonight. So I wanted to begin with a poem. It's a found poem. So I didn't write it, I found it and I put it into the form of a poem. And it's written, I found it in the diaries of Humphrey O'Sullivan, who was writing in the 1820s, 1830s in Callan, County Kilkenny. His diaries are quite famous. They're written in Irish and they're translated. So they're quite small, really, little jottings about his days and what he ate and what's happened. And you get a very good idea from his diaries of the times. And then suddenly he describes getting lost in the bog, coming home through Powler Capel, and he meets a woman, the woman from Powler Capel Bog, and she's crying. She's crying because she's been evicted. And he writes down what she says, and it's quite different, her words through him are quite different to the rest of the diary. And I just was very moved by them, because I think they take us back to a time when we were in a kind of relationship with nature that most of us have lost. So this is with the compliment of my friend on the street, Humphrey O'Sullivan meets the woman from Powler Capel. It was my husband who built that house. It was I who put soot on the rafters. But the son of Pauline again took the door off the jamb and the hinges off the hooks. He left the cabin without a door, the window without a pane of glass, the hearth without a fire, the chimney without smoke, the pigsty without sow, boar, or bonnet. I'll never again hear my cow low to her calf, my mare neigh to her foal or her colt, my sheep bleat to her lamb, my goat meg to her kid, my hen cackle to her chicks, nor my cock crow. I won't be here to see again either my white duck or my spotted drake, my hatching goose or my fair gander. I won't see the bog lake. I'll no more the heron's cry, the lapwings or the plover's call, nor the jack-snipe's bleat. I won't see the cormorant again. I won't hear the water hen. I won't drain the pool to catch an eel or a pike. It is far from them all, I, myself, my poor persecuted husband, and my ruined children are being sent. I won't be here to grow sweet white-topped water mint in the meadow by the pool, nor the white and red clover in my dry meadow. I won't set the flax seed, I'll not cut the flax, I'll not steep it in the pool. I'll not draw a thread from my spinning wheel or my distaff. I'll make no more yarn. My spinning wheel is in the ditch, my press in the sandpit, my table on the fence, my pot in the undergrowth, my chair out in the rain. My straw bed has no cover, sheet or mattress, my head no cap, my back no cloak. telling us what she's lost, she reestablishes what is, what was. So I made all sorts of scattered notes to myself about what I might or would or should or could say. I suppose one of the reasons I read that is that we live in this time of eviction, a lot of people living on the streets, which is very 19th century really. A lot of people moving from one country to another, about 65 million refugees in the world today. And Stephen Hawking has recently said we've got about 100 years left on planet Earth before we are evicted from here as a species. So I don't know if that's true or not. I have friends who tell me we've got 15 years. So I think what we're all experiencing is an eviction from an earlier way of thinking and being in the world. So kind of an eviction from an earlier, more peaceful psyche that we no longer can have when we're constantly looking into a very uncertain future. So that makes us slightly different people to the ones, the normal neurotics that we could be in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. We can no longer be normal neurotics. We have to be these slightly different versions. So I'm going to read this poem that I wrote specifically for this evening. And maybe it's quite a long poem, but I thought people will cope. They have drinks in their hand. Most people are comfortable. I appreciate some people standing up. And it does go on, so just sink into both feet. But I'm not going to read a huge number of poems this evening. I just specifically brought this because it's material I have been working with, and material I've been thinking a lot about for the last while. I will just say this little piece here that I put on this piece of paper, because I've been working on this novel, and Pat is sitting here. I tried to write this novel nearly 20 years ago, and I remember you inviting me down to read at a children's literature festival in Cork, and I had an earlier version of the novel, and then I abandoned it for 10 years because I just could not write it. I went back in 4 years ago, and I also can't write it, but I'm still doing it anyway. But what we're looking at the moment is overpopulation. We're looking at the kind of overpopulation which stands beside resource distribution. So perhaps all the wealth and the resources are in one part of the world and not in another. We're looking at recession, economic collapse, banking failure. We're looking at government inaction. We're looking at overdependence on one commodity. We're all reliant on oil for our next meal. And a change in the climate or an environmental condition that might alter, and capitalism run amok. And those are exactly the same things that were here in Ireland in the 1840s. Not climate change, but the blight, not the dependence on oil, but the potato. So all those other things are here, and this parallel just fascinates me. But the potato gets a lot of the credit for the situation that happened in Ireland in the famine in the 40s. But really, it was an economic famine. And one of the little pieces of information I found was a report about a ball at the castle in Dublin where there were orange citron trees, what they call citron trees, with oranges and lemons on the trees in March. And for me, I became very fascinated by these orange and lemon trees at a ball in March 1848. So that's what the poem is all around. I felt that that was a kind of valid addition to the discussion on nature in Irish history and culture. So I'm just going to have some of this very gassy water here. So it is a long poem, so kind of swing in and out, drift in and out. Listen to me, listen to the sounds, listen to your neighbor. And maybe some things, some images will stay, and to see what impressions you may be left with. So I mentioned the citron trees. We call them citrus trees, but at that point, a lot of the little pieces that are in the poem, I've taken phrases or words from newspapers. And I love these little particularly peculiar old phrases that have dropped away. So some of them are in here. One of them is gas brilliance, which I imagine are kind of like a little Bunsen burner that moves off a flame as a decoration. I'm going to remind you that Lord Clarendon was the Lord Lieutenant, so he was the sort of British head man up in Dublin Castle, and he appears throughout the poem. And the other people who make their way into the poem are some of the young Irelanders, who you may know were these very heroic writers, poets, editors, who kept this whole revolutionary movement going through the first 3 years of the famine until the British suppressed it. And they're really heroes, I suppose, and if this poem is about anything at all, I think it's about these tiny moments, tiny little symbolic gestures of what heroism might look like, and how we need to bring those sort of symbols, sometimes those symbols come into our poems, and they resonate a lot more. So the 1848 rebellion is really mostly written about in Irish history books as a bad fight in the cabbage patch in Tipperary. And it really wasn't that. I don't know why history has kind of left us with that. One of the big things that came out of the 1848 rebellion is the Irish flag that was created by Thomas Francis Mahon, and he flew it out of a window in Waterford in March 1848. So that's what most of the things you need to know. The other person who comes to the poem is John Mitchell, who was the editor of the Nation newspaper, who was sent to prison for 14 years for his writing. Citron trees bearing fruit. It is March 1848, St. Patrick's Day. Shamrock is being sold for the penny a bunch, and it is raining. A heavy, soaking rain that has cleared the streets and drowned the flags that hang wet from their windows and ash poles. They are French flags, red, white, and blue, and Ireland is covered with them, for it is 3 weeks since the Paris Revolution that toppled the king and saw the French monarchy flee to England, and Ireland is still celebrating. Every Frenchman has been given the vote. There will be paid work for the unemployed. No child in France shall ever go hungry again. And this matters because it is March, a bitter spring. Ireland has endured another desolate winter, a third inconceivable year. She does not know it yet, but she has another 4 such years ahead of her still. But for now, Ireland is celebrating. The French tricolour flies in every town. So many hang from the masts of ships in Cove that visitors mistake the town for Calais. For the past fortnight, crowds have cheered the French Republic, and the temperance bands have played spirit-stirring, emotional airs. It has been a time of flame, bonfires blazing on the hills and in the market squares. Every window lit with a candle, while the trades have kept their shops illuminated until the dawn. A time of tar barrels. At Athboy, 2 were hoisted to the steeple, where they burned 100 feet above the ground. In Clonmel, flaming kegs were tipped on their sides and rolled up and down Main Street until an early hour. But now it is St. Patrick's Day. Shamrock is being sold for a penny a bunch, and it is raining, a heavy rain that has cleared the streets. Even so, all eyes are on Dublin, for who knows what is about to happen. The authorities believe this is the day rebellion will come, for Paris has spread rebellion everywhere, and the streets of Europe are being bathed in blood. In Vienna, the troops are firing on the students. Milan is under siege. Poland, Austria, Germany, palaces burn and the people flee. Even Glasgow has seen riots, the glass of 1,000 gas lamps smashed. The mob plundering gun shops to flourish weapons like madmen or drunkards, shouting, "Down with the Queen!" 20,000 special constables have been sworn in to protect Scotland. The Admiralty is preparing for any kind of calamity, and everyone knows that Ireland will be next. But Ireland is not seen so much as a broken flower pot. It is St. Patrick's Day. Shamrock is being sold for a penny a bunch, and it is raining. Tonight, there will be repeal meetings in 3,000 parishes, and public banquets to honor France. But who knows what will happen? Lord Clarendon has warned Westminster the public mind is in a state of feverish excitement. Any untoward act will start an insurrection, especially in Cork. A desperate run has been made on the savings banks. 10,000 extra troops are quartered in Dublin. Navy frigates, the Gorgon and the Birkenhead, are berthed on the Liffey Quays. The castle armed with additional guard. Tonight, the dragoons will sleep beside their horses, and the horses remain saddled and shod in such a manner as to enable them to charge over broken glass. It is St. Patrick's Day, and Ireland is waiting for a sign, perhaps the stopping of the stagecoaches, like in 98. From Cork to Belfast, John Mitchell writes, they are watching, brave men, enslaved men, ready to die rather than endure 1 year of slavery more. Hungry men, evicted men. For it is impossible to quantify the distress in the country just then. Appalling accounts come in from every province. Shoals of peasantry swarm to the workhouses. Hundreds crawl the streets black with fever. Night falls, and the people come with candles to administer to the dying. And in Partrie, as if in mockery of the situation, the troops have been called in to collect the rates. It is clear 1 million people have already died. What are Irish taxes spent on? John Mitchell rails. Each year, £9 million are sent like tribute to England. But what returns? The £50,000 recently promised to the pauper districts is the same sum recently voted to improve the buildings of the British Museum. The £100,000 loaned back to Ireland for the calamity of 1846 is half of what is being spent on the laying out of Battersea Park. But tonight, there's no time to think of such things. Tonight is the St. Patrick's Ball at the castle. We must hurry or the rain will delay us. Who knows what is going to happen? The authorities are sure that tonight rebellion will come. Lord Clarendon has just received an anonymous letter informing him he will be fired on during the ball. Do hurry. The 900 guests are gathering. The ladies all dressed in fashions of Irish manufacture. And listen, the orchestra is striking up St. Patrick's Day in the morning. Lady Plunkett and Earl Mount Charles are about to commence the dancing. Quadrilles, waltzes and polkas will be kept up with great spirit until an early hour. Such excitement, so exhausting. It's quite the relief to hear supper is being served in the round room. To reach it, we must pass through chambers enchanting as fairy bowers. Fountains sparkle. Goldfish swim in glass vases. Gas brilliance dart forth slender lights. Arches of festoonery entwine above our heads. Rare exotics in full bloom. Orchids and citron trees. Citron trees in March. Oranges ripe for picking. Lemons brighter than the sun. See how prettily the canaries and linnets sing in their branches. But where have such plants come from? How are they here, these lemon trees, in March? All this must have taken the gardeners hours, must have cost a small fortune. But hush, for there's Lord Clarendon. He seems a little nervous, does he not? Beside him, that's the Countess. She's wearing a dress bordered with lace made at the Castle Coma School. It's silk embroidered with shamrocks, stitched in emerald and gold. She seems to be enjoying herself. To see her there among the orchids, we might almost forget this was Ireland. But look again, look at the colours around her, at the citron trees proffering their orange fruit, at the singing linnets with their small white breasts, at the shamrocks stitched in emerald green. Here are the colours of the new flag that Thomas Francis Meagher has so recently unfurled from a window in Waterford. It is true that within the overall scheme of things, these are just minute swatches of colour, but it is not yet their time. For now, they must wait in the wings of history. For now, we can only look centre stage at their excellencies, the Earl and Countess of Clarendon, the Earl with his rather nervous visage, and the Countess with her pale, fleshy neck and its splendid profusion of diamonds. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed for listening. It's very kind of you to give me your ears so sweetly for such a long time. I'm just going to finish with two short poems that are more about me now and how I try to make sense of living in this world where we've got the absolute doom and gloom on the one hand, and yet we have to carry on pretending that that's not happening in order to bring food on our tables. This poem is called Pace. Like a woman who goes to her lover's room when he is not there, I go to the woods. Like a woman laying her hand on each of his possessions and loving him all the more, I walk in the trees and touch pine cone, leaf, feather, husk. All is a longing to catch sight of squirrel, badger, deer. The forest pulling me deeper in until the trees reveal it's not a glimpse of wildness that I crave, but more like one of those stories where the stranger welcomed into the family home turns out to be a fox. Or like the fisherman's wife who, after long years of marriage, proves to be a seal. Sometimes my need is to lie down beneath the pines, to curl heart to earth, only the breath, only fur. And this little piece is my answer to Stephen Hawking. It's called I Thought I Was Done With Those Poems. I've never read it in public before, but it is in fur. I thought I was done with those poems, but then she took to wandering naked, feeling wind and sunlight on her breasts. Sometimes she squatted to relieve herself beneath trees, beneath stars. It became imperative to do these things, to know that she had been here, creaturely, sensate, on the earth. Thank you very much.